Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, as impeachment hearings continue, Representative Chris Stewart defends the president. A legislative audit contains troubling findings about oil and gas regulators. And new survey data underscores gender inequality in Utah. And joining me for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Good morning, Tommy. Welcome.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Reporter Becky Jacobs, welcome, Becky, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we've also got news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. As we did last week, we're going to kick things off this week with the impeachment hearings. And, you know, I said they were ongoing, but they've kind of actually wrapped up for the time being. And Thomas Burr, before we get to the responses to the testimony that we've been hearing, can we talk about basically what we know so far from these hearings? The witnesses have been painting a pretty consistent picture, and that picture is of pressure from the president and from his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on the then newly elected president of Ukraine. What are the sort of bullet points of what we've learned so far, Thomas Burr?
You mean you didn't listen to every minute of the testimony, like all Americans, I'm sure? It was quite a week, that's for sure. 9 witnesses in 3 days. And it was kind of a consistent picture. If you want to take it from an angle of Democrats, incredibly damning that pretty much every witness came forward and said, you know, there was a quid pro quo. They can't say it was directly from the president, but they assumed so, that there was a, you know, kind of shadow diplomacy going on with Rudy Giuliani and the some other folks, and really that it painted the picture Democrats wanted to, that the president was leveraging $250 million in military aid, another $150 million in State Department funds to Ukraine, and also a White House meeting with their new president, Zelensky, to get an investigation into Joe Biden and his son, Hunter, as well as trying to muddy the waters when it came to who actually interfered in the 2016 election. The GOP and Trump want to, the president wants to, you know, kind of spin it that it was Ukraine that really meddled instead of Russia. It wasn't necessarily the best week for some of these witnesses. In fact, yesterday you saw the Republican counsel, Castor, questioning Fiona Hill. And sometimes it was one of those things when you're a lawyer, you're supposed to always know the answer before you ask the question. He seemed a little befuddled by some of the answers that she was giving.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess maybe you could give some examples of that. She is a sort of specialist on policy. I can't. She was with the National Security Council, a top official.
Russia.
On Russia with the National Security Council. What were some of the surprising responses that she gave to questioning that led to the sort of consternation from the attorney that the Democrats on the committee had hired?
I was tweeting yesterday that in a future Democratic administration, I could see her being Secretary of State. Very diplomatic in her responses. I think, you know, she was really trying to just not be partisan, but show, like, you know, she actually seemed to support what was going forward in the impeachment process, because what she saw was just contrary to what foreign diplomacy the United States has had longstanding practice for. I think one of my favorites was when she was kind of asked about, well, you know, isn't there something shady about, you know, Hunter Biden doing something while his, you know, his dad is the vice president? And I think her response was something about how, well, it seems there's always questions of conflict when you have, you know, sons or daughters or family members of somebody in the White House. I think that might have been an allusion to, you know, the Trump people who might actually work for the White House.
Sure, the number of family members who do.
Yes.
You know, since we spoke last Friday, we've seen a number of witnesses. And one thing that I've noticed is that, or at least in a lot of the testimony that I've heard, and no, I have not listened to every waking minute of it, but, you know, defenders of the president, among them Representative Chris Stewart, who we will get to his response in just a minute, but they largely haven't been engaging in personal attacks or uncivil attacks against the witnesses. I've seen exceptions, of course, but by and large, these, you know, dozen witnesses have been treated with a degree of respect, and I guess the level of respect you'd expect from you know, or for these career diplomats and political analysts in the service of the U.S. government. I mean, there haven't been really strong attacks against them by those who were trying to defend the president, right?
You know, there were a couple of examples I'd bring out. First, I do believe Alexander Vindman, who's a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, when he was testifying at one point, he was referred to as Mr. Vindman, and he said, you know, he corrected me, said, you know, excuse me, Devin Nunes, Mr. Chairman, ranking member, sorry, refer to me as lieutenant colonel, you know, kind of this, you know, I do have this rank and I earned it. But I think one of the most amazing examples of that this week was Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who was very involved in everything going on with Ukraine. Before he started testifying, Devin Nunes, the ranking member from Republican from California, started off by saying, "You're going to be smeared here, and I apologize for that, and we look forward to your testimony." And then Sondland actually came forward as one of the Democrats' best witnesses so far, talking about absolutely there's a quid pro quo, and the top echelons of the White House knew about it and were encouraging it. So in the opposite of what the Republicans expected, maybe this is a good witness for us, it was actually not.
I mean, just back on the point of whether or not there was a smear campaign against any of them, and you know, in that instance, you're talking about smears possibly coming from the Democratic side, but from the Republican side defending the president. I mean, there were some people asking witnesses if they were never Trumpers, but it wasn't as though there was a full-throated attempt to discredit these witnesses, right?
Yeah, and I didn't really answer your question before. I think there was a point where they knew that character assassination wasn't going to work, and so essentially there was an effort by Republicans to, you know, change the narrative by talking about, oh, well, didn't, you know, Ukraine also have people that were part of this, you know, Steele dossier? Weren't there, you know, Ukrainians who wanted, you know, Hillary Clinton to win instead of Trump? You know, to a little bit of a sideshow to direct the attention away from some of the testimony.
And something that witness that we mentioned before, Fiona Hill, strongly rejected as a conspiracy theory. Yeah. Robert Gerke is a news columnist at the Tribune, and I want to bring you in on this conversation before we turn to the reaction of Utah representatives, namely Chris Stewart, just on the impeachment process so far this week.
Yeah, sort of touching on what Tommy was just saying. I mean, I think the biggest winner of this week on the whole thing is the U.S. career diplomatic corps. I mean, we saw terrific performances from Bill Taylor, George Kent, Fiona Hill, Alexander Vindman. All of these people represented themselves very well under some, you know, sometimes hostile, sometimes, you know, goading questioning. The picture you got from listening to their stories was that they were doing their level best to implement U.S. foreign policy, and that they were being confronted with challenges at every turn by President Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and his shadow irregular diplomatic channels. And so
the
three amigos. And I mean, even Sondland, like he's a pro-Trump guy. He gave Trump a lot of money for his campaign.
$1 million.
He gave him $1 million. He's you know, his ambassador, his guy. He came off as at least a credible, maybe honest broker, you know, in the sense that the testimony he was giving to the committee wasn't flattering. And when you have somebody who's a pro-Trump guy giving unflattering testimony, you kind of give that a little bit more credence, I think, in when you're weighing it against the others. I mean, it was, as Tommy kind of joked about at the start, you know, there was a lot of testimony. There was a lot to digest. I don't think that the American public necessarily was hanging on the edge of their seat all the time, you know, but I do think that the information that came out points to one thing that needs to happen now. I mean, the Republicans kept coming back to this line. It's hearsay. You didn't have direct conversations with the president. You know, Rudy Giuliani didn't actually tell you this. It almost seems like at this point you need to have Bolton, Giuliani, and possibly Trump answering questions about what they did and what happened from their perspective, because you have all these people who were interacting with them on a regular basis telling the same story. But, you know, you kind of need to have, instead of Fiona Hill talking about her interaction with John Bolton, who was the national security advisor, maybe have Bolton himself in there. And right now they're refusing to do that.
Right.
Can I kind of just jump in there?
Sure,
I
Tommy.
Think that was the, just to underscore what Robert was saying, it was the continuing message all week from publicans that we don't have any, no one actually knows what's going on. None of these witnesses actually were in the room kind of situation. But like you said, they refused to testify. They refused to turn over documents. There could be an obstruction of justice charge in the articles of impeachment. Because the Republicans, you know, say, oh, this isn't, you know, there's no there,
right.
But they wouldn't let the people who actually knew what there is testify.
Let's turn actually then now to what Representative, you know, our Congressman Chris Stewart is saying. I mean, he's in these hearings because he's a member of this committee. And while, you know, witnesses are offering testimony underlining this, you know, request to investigate the Bidens in Ukraine, yeah, Congressman Stewart has been essentially sticking to the line that this is all a sham and political theatrics. Is that correct, Tommy?
Yeah, absolutely. He's been one of the president's strongest defenders during this impeachment hearings, joining his fellow Republicans and trying to, you know, to again, change the narrative and saying yesterday, for example, that he called it impeachapalooza this week, impeachapalooza, and actually saying yesterday that it's good news that they're kind of wrapping up this phase of the impeachment inquiry, because when it gets to the Senate, as I think we all expect, actually, the Senate will be able to have, you know, Republican witnesses and, you know, have a kind of due process Republicans have been asking for in a trial. But he has been critical of witnesses. He's been trying to, you know, take the narrative away from what the Democrats' goal of finding, you know, was there quid pro quo, and saying, well, look, they started quid pro quo, and now we're to bribery, now we're to extortion. And at one point, he said he had to look up what extortion meant. You know, it's his whole entire goal this week, and using every, you know, minute he had to chat with the witnesses, was to redirect.
And he wasn't alone in doing that. During Wednesday's hearing, Stewart said the American people aren't stupid. And he was talking about how eventually Ukraine did get the military aid that was going to be held up, supposedly, and how the president of Ukraine has said that he doesn't feel or he hasn't felt pressured by Trump. And so Stewart says the American public will say that that this doesn't amount to extortion or the exchange of a bribe, as you're pointing out there, Tommy. I'm going to sound like a broken record here, because this is something that I've asked a few times on this show. You know, whatever the president of Ukraine felt, whether or not the aid was withheld, or for that matter, a White House visit was withheld, does that really matter? Or is it that the president and his colleagues tried, and maybe this is a question I should direct at Robert Gierke, the columnist.
If I could jump in.
Sure.
The aid is appropriated by Congress. They tell, you know, the State Department and the DOD to release the aid. The Secretary of Defense had certified that the Ukraine had complied with the anti-corruption efforts. I believe that was in May. If Tommy can correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
The money was not released. This is Fiona Hill and Laura Cooper went into quite a bit of detail about this. But the money was not released because it had been directed by the OMB to not release it because of this. These conditions hadn't been met. The Burisma and 2016 CrowdStrike investigations had not been delivered as promised, and that was contrary to the stated foreign policy set by the Trump administration in regards to aid to the Ukraine,
supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression.
And so we go through July when there's the phone call when the favor was asked, where Trump specifically names CrowdStrike and Biden, the perfect phone call, as he puts it. You go through August, and you get into September, and the money ends up being released right as Congress is learning about this whistleblower. And so the timing of the events, even though and Zelensky, by the way, goes right up to the brink of calling this press conference. There was a statement going back and forth about promises, commitments to do the investigations into CrowdStrike, 2016 election tampering, Burisma, Biden's, right? And so the timing of it, just because the bag full of unmarked dollar bills didn't get dropped off at the Trump White House doesn't mean there wasn't a bribery scheme in place. So I think that, yes, you can technically argue that Trump did not gain what he had planned to gain from this necessarily, but the scheme was in place. The office was used in a manner that was not that was an abuse of power. That's the argument that Democrats are going to make. And I think after this week's hearings, there's a lot of substance to that.
Sorry, Robert, to interrupt you, but just to play up your analogy, there was several Democrats this week who used the example of, if I walk into a bank with the intent to rob it, I hand the teller the note, and they laugh in my face, and the cops arrest me, that's still a crime. Doesn't mean because I didn't get the money that I didn't do something wrong.
You know, the thing that kept coming back to me during listening to a lot of these hearings, because I listened to it way more than I probably should have, is healthy for anybody, is that even if the Ukraine had actually initiated these investigations, you would have to question whether those are valid investigations, whether the results of those investigations are legitimate because of the fact that there's this $400 million in foreign aid that is crucial to the country that is being attacked by Russia. So they're going to go out and if they were to do the investigation because they had the gun to their head and came back with results, you'd have to figure the results are going to be tainted by that. Anyway, we pay prosecutors $100 million to go out and investigate somebody. That's not the way the system is supposed to work here or there. And frankly, that is corruption in itself when you're tying prosecutions, investigations to payments of critical foreign aid. And it's just the whole thing. It was probably a bad week for Republicans. Bad week for Trump and a pretty shameful week for Chris Stewart, who probably was the least useful of all of the members on the committee on either party.
Well, again, the opinion columnist gets to opine. Hey, listeners, you can weigh in here with your phone calls and your questions and comments. 801-355-TALK is the number to call. That's 801-355-8255. Tommy, you pointed out the fact that, you know, we are widely expecting impeachment to happen in the House, and then this will move to a Senate trial. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the next steps are, as we expect, well, one, thank goodness for Thanksgiving next week, and that's what I'm giving thanks for. So we have a little bit of a break, 1 week break before Congress returns. What we expect is the Intelligence Committee, which has been doing this phase of the investigation, will hand over some kind of report to the Judiciary Committee, which could, if it wanted to, hold its own hearings. It's kind of doubtful they need to go through that process and elongate it. The Judiciary Committee then writes up what we expect, articles of impeachment, which could be numerous at this point from what Democrats are saying. And then the House votes. Democrats have the majority, even if a few people, perhaps Ben McAdams, I don't know how he's going to vote on this. They could lose a few Democrats and still pass and impeach the president. And then we go to a Senate trial. They're already preparing in the Senate for what could be a two-week trial. Some Trump and GOP allies are saying they should make it a long trial and, you know, just keep it going through, you know, the Democratic primaries and hopes that it actually, you know, hurts some people like Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker, who are in the Senate and have to be there. So this is not going to be ending anytime soon.
You pointed out that Chris Stewart was looking forward to the idea of this getting to the Senate. What? Because he wants to have basically a different accounting, I guess, there than is happening in the House, correct?
Yeah, it's a different process. I'd like to try to explain this to people. This is kind of the grand jury process. This is where, you know, they bring in witnesses and they testify for the prosecution. The defense doesn't necessarily get to call in witnesses. But when you get to a trial situation, which would be in the Senate, Chief Justice John Roberts gets to preside over that. And the GOP can call their own witnesses. They can call whomever they'd like, really, and try to, you know, counter the narrative that Democrats are going to portray in the articles of impeachment.
Okay. Again, this is Tommy Burr in Washington, Thomas Burr, Washington bureau chief with the Salt Lake Tribune. We have a question, actually. This is a crystal ball question from Chris in St. George, who didn't stay on the line. He writes, how many senators would vote if it was a secret vote? You know what I mean? Like, how many you have people who would probably, because of the political calculus of the public vote, might vote differently. I don't know how anybody can answer that question.
Yeah,
I
mean,
well, there has been conjecture that there would be more than publicly vote to impeach the president and remove him from office, but it's not how the Constitution is set up, and it requires a public vote.
Okay. We need to head to our first break in the show. Reminder that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And when we come back, we will turn to a look at a new survey of the experiences of Utah women. Stay with us.
Support for news programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create inclusive communities and improve the lives of children and adults through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
a Thanksgiving feast of songs about food and drink.
Please, mister, don't touch me, tomato. Please don't you touch me, tomato. Touch me, yummy pumpkin potato. For goodness sake, don't touch me, tomato.
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Pack your bags and join us for the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank Thompson Premier Lighting and Appliance for sponsoring UPR programming. Find out how you can become a sponsor by emailing debbie.andrew@usu.edu. We would also like to thank our listeners and members. Remember, you can now listen and contribute.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, reporter Becky Jacobs, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or tweet to @KCPW. Becky Jacobs, I want to turn to reporting that you did this week on the sentiments of Utah women about their place in society in our state. There has been a fair amount of reporting on disparities in pay, in political representation, and so on, but there hasn't been the information that you compiled through a statewide poll. And there's a lot in this poll, but just from the data that you have looked at so far, maybe you could describe the poll to us and the big takeaways from it.
Yeah, so this poll, there's always been the national rankings that we've kind of read about women's equality in Utah, and we wanted to hear the local voices here and kind of answer some of the unanswered questions of what women here feel like being a woman in Utah is like. So that's kind of what this poll did. We started by asking if women believe they have an overall lower status than men in Utah, and about 53% said definitely or probably, and about 37% said definitely not or probably not.
And when we say status, we mean sort of societal rank, hierarchy in the world?
Yeah, we left it kind of general on purpose because we wanted to kind of see how women would interpret that. And I think they interpret it different ways, but when you go to the challenges question that we asked, I think that kind of gives a little more clarity of what they were thinking when they answered the first question.
Right. And you know, we talk about the wage gap here in Utah. That was one item that that women listed as a challenge for them. That was front of mind for them in this survey.
Right. When we went to the challenges, the top two were actually evenly split of what women chose. By a slight lead, they chose low wages in our survey, and that was quickly followed by cultural expectations about gender roles. And those were kind of the two leading. Domestic violence and sexual assault came in at about 18% compared to the top two that were about 27%. But I think it kind of shows the issues that they were thinking about when they answered the status question.
Cultural expectations about gender roles. You reported, Becky, that some of the women surveyed talked about the perceived religious pressure to get married and have kids. I mean, that's not, I think, unexpected in a state that is predominantly of one faith. And then, you know, that kind of gets back to the question of status. There was a quote that talked about the interplay between pay and those cultural pressures and attitudes. There's a woman from St. George who you quote saying that there's this idea that you don't need to pay women a lot because the thinking, according to what this woman is seeing in St. George, is that employers, quote, figure women have other roles that they'll eventually go into, meaning I don't have to pay them much because eventually they're going to leave and take on one of these other roles.
Yeah, and that's something that's come up. Some of the women that took the poll agreed to speak with a reporter about their responses. And some of the things that came up was that they felt like if a man was going into a job and and negotiating his pay that they would think he needs to support his family. Whereas if a woman goes in, maybe they might think she has a husband or someone else that might support her. But with that cultural expectations about gender roles, that's kind of a hard thing to quantify. And that was something we wanted to try to identify with this survey, because it comes up anecdotally in interviews all the time. But to try to have people explain what they thought that meant in Utah. And motherhood and work and family were words that came up a lot when women were trying to define that for us.
You know, we're talking about this, the cultural expectations and the, you know, some of that coming from the faith community that a person might belong to, and not just the predominant faith in Utah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But there was this interesting stat that you reported from this survey, and it says, you know, of very active Latter-day Saints who were surveyed, and again, all of them are women, 41% said women definitely did not have a lower status. I know this is sort of raw data, but why would it be that someone who was a very active member of the faith, you know, wouldn't see as much of a disparity in social status between men and women? Maybe that's not a question that you can answer. This is just survey data.
I don't know if that is a question I can answer yet. I think as we talk to people more, and maybe some of the experts that have studied this, they might have some more insight on that. But the interesting thing when we looked at status and challenges is that it was pretty consistent across different demographics. But we tried to see where there were some differences. And when you looked at the status question, with very active LDS women, they were more likely to say less likely to have a lower status. Then when you move to somewhat LDS women or somewhat active, they were a little more evenly split about the status. About 30% said, you know, they have a overall lower status, and 25% were more likely to say they didn't have an overall lower status. And then when you move to not active LDS women, it kind of flipped, where they thought that they did have an overall lower overall status. And kind of cited more that way.
It's interesting because we have this other data pointing to these, you know, those cultural expectations being a big, one of the big challenges in the state. But then, yeah, women with, you know, women who are further, I guess, or less active in the faith feel that pressure more than those who are more active in the faith is essentially what this data is sort of demonstrating, I guess.
Yeah, and I think Erin Jemison with YWCA made a really good point that a lot of these women probably base this on either their personal experiences or something that happened to someone they know, or just kind of a perceived general expectation. So when I was talking to women, a lot of them would base it on how they personally have felt, if they've had a lower status or not, or they kind of focused on different general ideas. And I think it just kind of varied between each person.
Right, of course. I think I have a question here for the columnist in the room, and not a reporter, Robert Gerke. Doesn't, you know, we look at the gender wage gap here in Utah, and for a time, and it may still be the biggest in the United States, on average, 70 cents on the dollar earned by a man is what a woman earns in the state of Utah, from what I remember.
Yeah,
doesn't that wage gap basically prove that there is a lower status? Am I stretching too much there?
Becky, what do you think? I would seem to think that If you're measuring status based on wages, then yes, that's probably what that would show. And I think what if I could project perhaps a little bit onto this question about active LDS and less active LDS,
sure.
I think they see their status as being valued apart from their wages and their place in their job in the workplace. So. Maybe they're stay-at-home moms, but they see that as valuable in itself. So I think that's where you get into some of these questions about status and wage not necessarily being the same metric, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I think so. Becky, any comments on that?
I think that's a good point. If we had had a series of questions of asking about your status based on different topics of, you know, wage gap or gender roles or domestic violence, I think there might be some variation in some answers. But I think wage gap is just one thing that factors into this overall bigger picture for women in Utah.
Do you want to, you know, there's a lot more data, as I understand, that was compiled from this survey, and more stories will be coming out of this, correct?
Yeah, we have a series of stories that are going to be coming out. We asked about a bunch of different topics that we think affect women in Utah, and I'm excited to keep reporting those and seeing people's reactions.
Do you want to talk about or say anything about the funding for this survey? It was a, I mean, you yourself are a Report for America reporter here stationed at the Salt Lake Tribune focusing on women's issues or on women, on the role of women, I guess, in society. And then this survey was funded by a sort of unique method. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we got a grant from the Facebook Journalism Project and from the Lenfest Institute for Journalism to do this survey. And so with that grant, we were able to partner with Suffolk University and survey the 400 women across Utah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Robert Gerke, do you have any more, you know, additional comments on just the fact that there is this disparity between men and women in Utah and also that they feel it, you know?
Well, as a white middle-aged man, I think these women are getting a little emotional about everything. I'm kidding, of course, before anybody punches their radio. No, I think it's important. Look, we can work towards solutions, but we also have to listen to and understand the perception of what is happening on the ground. And I think that's what's important about moving past anecdote and getting data. And I think that's kind of what we're starting to get our hands around a little bit. And I think it kind of comes down to the opportunity being available. Not every woman should feel pressure to go work and be in the workplace and be a corporate executive or whatever. But they should have opportunities, the same opportunities to do that as men have. And until you start getting understanding the pressures that are there, the perceptions that they and the pressures that they feel that women feel, and you know, I think until you start understanding that, you can't start working toward providing the same opportunities as men have.
Becky, you talked about the fact that you are going to do other stories. How much larger was this survey in terms of the amount of data that can be pulled from it? How many more questions were there looking at the experience of women in Utah?
We had a little over 20 questions that we were able to ask. And so we have a handful of stories planned to come out next. And I think there will be more as we keep digging into the data. But yeah, there's a lot that we can still explore.
Okay. Again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW 88.3 FM in Salt Lake City and also on Utah Public Radio in Logan and around the state. I'm Roger McDonough. And if you want to join this conversation, you can call us 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. I want to turn now to a story that Robert Gerke, news columnist, was actually reported by Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley. He wrote this week about a legislative audit that uncovered something a little bit troubling having to do with how oil and gas regulators are operating in the state of Utah. And can you summarize that for us?
Yeah.
And then we can jump into your opining on it as well.
Right. Well, just the facts. We'll do a Joe Friday style right now.
Okay.
The legislative auditor had done an audit of the Department of Natural Resources. And during the course of that audit, they found some irregularities in the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining. This is the state division that's supposed to regulate and permit oil and gas wells across the state. And basically, they found that there was an inadequate culture of compliance, I guess you could say. There was not enough focused on ensuring the health and safety and environmental protections on these wells that it were being permitted. And in fact, the sort of the biggest takeaway, I think, is that it had been 24 years since they could document a fine being issued by this division. And if you think about that, if you compare it to surrounding states, all of the surrounding states that have active oil and gas production had seen fines levied in the last 2 years. You know, you're talking Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and I believe Idaho was the other one that they looked at. And so the question then became, well, is that because they're following the rules, or is it because that the division is toothless? And it turns out that there's 105 outstanding non-compliant wells across the state, or 105 instances of non-compliance at these wells across the state, and they have been allowed to languish for 2.5 years in on average before they're rectified. The state hadn't issued the notices of violations, hadn't issued levied fines, and so the auditors really question whether there's any whether the division's being taken seriously by these producers, and whether the division is doing its job that it's supposed to do to protect the health and safety. They identify two instances in particular where there were environmental risks that resulted from the company's failures to abide by the directives of the division. And in one instance, there was a evaporation pond that had leaked and potentially polluted groundwater. They're still trying to figure that out, or were still trying to figure out that out when the audit was completed. And then there was another one where basically petrochemicals sit on the surface of these ponds, and they're supposed to be removed so they don't threaten wildlife and so forth.
Right,
and
birds that land
within 24
ponds.
Hours, they're supposed to be removed, and they didn't do that. And so those are two examples, just recent examples, frankly, within the last few months, that they could point to where the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining's failure to do its job, basically, had exposed the public to or the environment to some risk.
I mean, was there a response, and I don't know if you can speak to this, but was there a response from the regulators themselves, from the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining?
The division says that they acknowledged, frankly, that there had been a failure to prioritize the compliant part of their job and to do the inspections, it was kind of interesting because the head of the division actually owned it a little bit and said that it starts at the top, it starts with me, and we're going to change. They said they've already whittled down the outstanding non-compliance issues from 109 to, I believe, 33. 105 to 33.
Right.
And so, you know, they said they're making progress on it. And so we will see, I guess.
All right. Well, now I want you to take off the Just the Facts hat and put on your editorial cap, because you wrote you did write a column about this,
yeah.
and basically lambasting the you know, leadership here in Utah for not looking out for the people and for the public lands that we could be enjoying. Can you talk about that?
The division really has one job, and their job is to regulate the oil industry, and if they're not regulating, if they're not doing that, if they're not doing their job on our behalf to protect our land, then what is the point of them existing in the first place, right? It seems like they've been cowed by the industry that they're supposed to be a watchdog for, and you know, we're suffering the consequences. We're you know, our public lands are not being protected are not being protected in the way that we expect them to be. You know, it's the 24 years thing is kind of mind boggling when you think about it. In 24 years, nobody had done anything worthy of a violation is just ridiculous to think about. The 24 years, it goes back to the last time, it's when O.J. Simpson was acquitted. And it was, as I put in my column, it was a year before Donovan Mitchell was born.
Right.
And in that entire time, they've failed to really, you know, have it. It's a toothless watchdog is what it is. Or a lapdog, if anything else. So I think it's, look, they've got a job to do. They need to start doing it. And if the leadership has allowed this for 24 years to go on, and his supervisors have allowed it to go on unchecked, then there needs to be some changes there. I don't think that we can trust that the same lapdog that's been asleep for the last 24 years is going to suddenly become a legitimate watchdog of the industry.
You and others wrote about the fact that there were companies out there that would get these notice of violations, and they would just ignore them because they knew there were no repercussions.
Yeah, there was one company that the auditors found that had been issued four violations that they just disregarded them because they knew that if there wasn't going to be a fine, they weren't going to follow up on it. They just kind of, you know, threw them in the trash can, and then went ahead and applied to drill more wells, which is kind of absurd when you think about it too. And there's a whole other part of this that I didn't really get into because sure. It's a little complicated. But there's supposed to be reclamation funds to cap these wells, to close them out. the division has exposed the public to financial risk because there's not adequate bonds in place. We've already had to spend about $250,000. We're going to have to spend about another $500,000 to close off some of these wells.
The public.
The public, taxpayers. You and I are going to have to spend that money to close off some of these wells because the companies have walked away from them and the division hasn't held them accountable for it.
I know this is complicated, but the bonding question, you're talking about the fact that there's not, you know, that there's $1 million in reclamation costs for abandoned wells. Where is that reclamation money supposed to be coming from?
Well, I mean, they're supposed to post a bond when they start drilling. The division is supposed to make sure that those bonds are adequate. And the legislature, frankly, is partly to blame for this, too. But the bonds need to be adequate to do the job. And we've seen this across the country, both on state and federal land, in state to state to state, that the states often end up getting stuck plugging abandoned wells by companies that don't have adequate resources to do it. They need to take a careful look at that. The auditor suggested that the legislature and the division take a careful look at whether the bonding, well, they said the bonding is inadequate, and so they need to look at what needs to be done to make sure that taxpayers are not on the hook for this.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. This is Glenn calling from the Uinta Basin. And Glenn, I understand you work in the oil field and have a comment about the topic that we're covering right now. Can I ask you for your comment?
Yes. I work for not a large producer, but we're a pretty good-sized producer here in the Uinta Basin. And the two instances cited, particularly the evaporation pond, which is a disposal, part of the disposal mm-hmm. process, and the other one, were both actually under the purview of the Division of Environmental Quality, and they do come out and make business, and I know they have posted fines. So I know DOGM, we call it DOGM, Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining, they are usually more into making sure we know what the rules are and how they are set up and that we agree to comply them. And then generally speaking, we
DEQ
end up being followed over by DEQ. So, and I'll also say I agree with the bonding issue. I think it's a $10,000 bond per well. If you have more than one well, you only have to post one or two bonds. It's ridiculously low. It is easily $1 million to put a well back into reclamation.
Into reclamation. So it's an interesting comment.
100% agree with that.
An interesting comment on DEQ being sort of in charge, and we don't have the reporter Brian Maffley who had this story, but Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on just the idea that, you know, there are other regulators out there besides the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining?
Yeah, I mean, I think DEQ comes in if there are violations or environmental damage that's done. I think the inspection part of it, again, DOGM is responsible for the inspection part of it going in. And one of the things they identified is that DOGM is spending too much time on sort of the routine inspections and less time on those 105 instances where there was non-compliant wells, on doing the follow-up on those. And so there's a question of prioritization of where they should be focusing their energy. As Glenn mentioned, should it be like on making sure they're aware of the rules and abiding by the rules, or is it once they've identified something that is non-compliant, sort of following up and making sure that gets fixed? And that's where you end up with this 835-day window for these non-compliance issues to be addressed. That's the average, which means some of them are a lot longer than that. So these non-compliance things are often lingering out there for 2.5 years or more. So,
Glenn, thanks very much for your call. And
can I say one more thing really quick?
Sure.
The Division of Environmental Quality is very proactive about checking into leaks at well sites and different mm-hmm. things. They actually have very expensive infrared cameras. They go just to look for gas leaks.
Right.
And we are required to do our own surveys on a periodic, every 90 days or so on each well to make sure we don't have leaking regulators, leaking fittings, leaking pipes. Mm-hmm. And we're required to send photos of these, whether it's broken, leaking or adequate, and they come out and check those. So the DEQ is very proactive about things like that.
Thanks very much. So, thanks, Glenn, for your call.
We got to
head to a break here. And Robert, we can revisit this maybe when we come back from the break. But there are, of course, the examples pointed out in this article of places where there was, leaking happening that wasn't getting resolved despite, the kinds of measures that Glenn is talking about there. I mean, do you want to comment on that really quickly, actually, before we head to a break?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the issue that was cited in the report was that in 2016, the Daugam had directed this company, agreed with this company. This company had agreed to replace all of its liners on these evaporative ponds. And by 2018, they didn't do it. And in 2019, Daugam found a leak. Now DEQ and EPA are coming in on the backside and trying to figure out if groundwater was contaminated. It apparently killed the vegetation around where this leak occurred. And so, you know, again, this was an issue identified in 2016. We saw no action by the operator. And then in 2019, we see a leak. And now DEQ and EPA are coming in behind it to try to figure out the damage done.
Okay. And again, that's Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines. We need to head to a break. There's still more to come, including our underplayed stories of the week. Again, this is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
On the next episode of California Burning, we study how fire works and how we can predict its behavior so we have a better chance of keeping our wild spaces and our communities safe.
If the flames are less than 4 feet in height, we usually consider that to be okay to be able to be there and be able to work on that.
Join us as we explore wildfires with those who understand it best.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
We'll talk turkey with Adam Gopnik from The New Yorker and remember Mary Oliver. She'll read her beautiful poems of Thanksgiving. I'm John Burge with music and stories for Thanksgiving. It's Giving Thanks from 8 p.m.
Join us Thanksgiving Day, 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr, Becky Jacobs, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. We have actually very little time to squeeze in one more story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. But Thomas Burr, I wanted to ask you about a story that you wrote just yesterday, I believe, or maybe the day before, about the relationship between the Republican National Committee's chairwoman and President Donald Trump and Mitt Romney. Trump and Romney, of course, have not necessarily had the best of relationships since before Romney became our freshman senator. Maybe I'll just have you recap the story since we're low on time.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Excuse me. And thank you for not calling me a pompous something. So yesterday I was at a breakfast with Ronna McDaniel, used to be known as Ronna Romney McDaniel, who is Mitt Romney's niece. And I was introduced, Tommy Burr from the Salt Lake Tribune, and she looks at me and she says, "You're going to ask about Uncle Mitt, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And my question was focused on how she's dealing with the situation of being the head of the Republican National Committee, whose job is to defend, all Republicans and keep Republicans elected, including this president, and having Mitt Romney as her uncle, who has been, highly critical of the president on occasion. And she, kind of noted, it's family, and everyone, families have disagreements. It's going to happen over the Thanksgiving table this week. And she said that on occasion, this was an interesting response, the president has called her and said, I'll just read the quote, "I will say, there have been times the president said, I'm sorry you have to deal with this." And just to clarify, the president's not saying, I'm sorry that I'm having this spat with Mitt Romney. He's pretty much saying, I'm sorry that, you're stuck here in the middle kind of thing. It was just kind of fascinating look inside this dynamic, which I don't think most Americans realize that, she's Romney's niece because she took her middle name, her maiden name, out of her professional name.
Sure, yeah, and then she herself has been kind of critical of her uncle, who, when he first came in as senator in at the beginning of the year, she was sort of chastising him on Twitter for calling out the president. Am I right about that?
Yes, absolutely. And there's been a few other times too, because her job is not to defend Romney necessarily. Defend the president and Republicans overall. And when Romney wrote the op-ed to the Washington Post and, said that he wasn't sure the president was up to, the standards of the office, the Oval Office, she said, hey, incoming, you know, Republican freshman, better if you're with us, and it's inappropriate for you to feed into the narrative that Democrats and the media want. So, you know, it is an interesting dynamic between the two. There was a follow-up question, and no, she's not going to Thanksgiving dinner with Mitt Romney. Okay. She's going to have her own.
Okay, great. I was just about to
ask
that question.
She's going to be dining with Pierre Delecto.
The pseudonym, the pseudonym Twitter account. I don't know how to say that word. You know what, Gerke, do you have any comments on this before we head to our final segment, the underplayed stories? I mean,
no, the only part of it I don't believe is that Trump said he was sorry about anything. I mean, it is. It's prickly. It's got to be prickly for both Rona and for Mitt, Senator Romney, and you know. So, but they'll navigate it. They're grownups.
All right.
I should have added that Romney replied really kindly yesterday, and he said, "I'm proud of my niece. She's a dedicated, loyal chairwoman. She is doing what's best for our party." And at the end of the day, we both agree that family is more important than politics.
So, and then Senator Romney went to the White House yesterday to meet with the president, if I'm not mistaken.
And he's going back again today, I just learned. So there we go.
Okay.
Best buds
all of a sudden. All right. You know what? We need to turn to our final segment, those underplayed stories of the week. And I'm going to bring reporter Becky Jacobs back into the conversation and ask her to kick things off. What is your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, one that was interesting from the perspective of my beat. Taylor Stevens did a profile that Murray and South Salt Lake are going to have female majority city councils next year for the first time. So if you want a nice, light, happy read, that's a good one to go revisit.
Go check it out. And again, yeah, that is your beat. You're here as a Report for America Corps member who is at the Tribune covering the stories of women in Utah. And thank you for that pick for Underplayed Story. Tommy Burr, your pick for Underplayed Story?
You know, there's so much going on in Washington this week, but this is a really fascinating move. We've never seen this before. The House Judiciary Committee actually advanced legislation to remove cannabis, to remove marijuana from the list of, you know, controlled drugs in America. I could see this possibly passing the House, who knows about the Senate, but Congress hasn't acted on marijuana legislation for a long time other than the more restricted. This is a pretty historic move.
Wow. Interesting pick, and one that definitely flew under my radar. Robert Gerke, your choice for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I mean, Courtney Tanner had a story in today's paper about the BYU-Idaho not accepting Medicaid as it's required in student insurance, and interviewed some students who are concerned that if they can't afford insurance on their own, if they have to get insurance in addition to Medicaid, they're not going to be able to afford their tuition, and they're going to have to drop out of school. And you know, some stonewalling kind of by the school in response to this. BYU in Provo was asked about it and said that they have not changed their policy. So this is limited to BYU-Idaho, but an interesting change nonetheless.
That's a great pick as well. I'm going to go with something that's hardly underplayed, but in case you missed it, the Road Home homeless shelter stopped providing services yesterday. People were moved, bused actually, to the newly opened Men's Resource Center in South Salt Lake. And there's a new model of trying to help the homeless in three new homeless resource centers, which have on-site counselors and detox facilities, showers, laundry, job services, and so on. But there's been this question of whether or not there are enough beds. And service providers and some advocates say that they're doing everything they can to ensure that people can get shelter. There's also been a housing push. Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens covered this thoroughly in the paper this morning, and it's worth a read. Check it out at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, Becky Jacobs, and Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving indeed. That wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his work on the show and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan as well. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. Next Friday, Behind the Headlines, we'll be taking a break for the Thanksgiving holiday, something that we've done every year for the past 6 years. So enjoy your holiday, and we'll try to get you caught up on all the local news you missed the following week. And until next time, I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great holiday, and see you again soon.
On the next On Being, physicist Marcelo Gleiser and novelist Marilynne Robinson.
It is inconceivable at this point that we could say anything final about what the human mind is, because it will surprise us over and over again.
Science was not so much about finding all the answers, but actually about courting with the mystery of the unknown.
I'm Krista Tippett. Join us.
Tune in Sunday evening at 5 o'clock to Utah Public Radio. A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.